Jarrett Taylor, American Renaissance. That's Amren, AMREN.com, as you can see up on the video screen. Mr. Taylor, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. All right, let's jump right into this as we're sifting through some audio things as Scott is in a different location. Okay. Historically speaking, Mr. Taylor, this is a country, United States, that was made by and for white people. Why is it that we have softened up our ideals, our stance, and seemingly, particularly south of the border, softened up our stance and allowed this open border policy, or at least so it seems?
I think there are many things that contribute to this. It goes back, several decades, actually. I think that white people first began to lose their nerve after the First World War. That was such a terrific bloodletting in which brother nations slaughtered each other in such huge quantities that it really made a lot of people wonder what kind of civilization this was, Western civilization, that permitted that kind of horrible disaster. And things got only worse after the Second World War. Of course, Nazism and the treatment of Jews is something that has been held against whites ever since. And I think that for a large number of white people, the idea of some kind of racial solidarity, the idea of having a goal as whites somehow was something that would be deleterious to the interests of others. There's been a kind of an across-the-board loss of nerve among whites so that they have lost the ability to say, this is our country, and we built it, and our ancestors built it for us, and we wish to keep it for our descendants. If it's to remain a white country, then you, Mexicans or Haitians or Guatemalans, we have no particular grievance against you, but you have to stay home. The whites have lost the ability to say that, and it's something that has happened worldwide, not just in the United States, but Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and Europe. Really, it's a worldwide collapse of white morale.
100%. It's unfortunate that that has indeed happened. I mean, there is no true sole homeland for the whites, as we'll get into a little bit. But just to follow up on that question, Mr. Taylor, we're obviously in the midst of two or three wars, whether or not we're winding down our military presence or not. We have a large presence in the Middle East. Do you believe that our troops who are fighting these wars abroad would be better served defending our borders, and the money that is also spent on this combat, whether it be for ammunition or what have you, do you believe that all of these resources would be better put towards better border control?
Oh, unquestionably. And I don't think that it would take one-tenth of the manpower and resources that we are splashing out in the Middle East to control our border properly. I think that the wars, first of all, Afghanistan and Iraq, are terribly wasteful. I think that once we are gone, those countries will essentially revert more or less to the state that they have always been in, and any attempt to impose Western civilization by shooting people is going to fail. So the longer we stay there, the longer we are simply putting off the inevitable, and more money we will spend, the more lives we will lose. As far as guarding the border is concerned, I think that really just a handful of troops on the border who really were prepared to be serious about guarding the border is all that it would take. I don't think that you would have to show much force for it to get across, for the message to get across to anyone who wanted to come illegally, that they would be stopped. And that would be pretty much the end of it.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%, of course, on that point as well. Now, here's the new topic for us here, as we have Reverend Scott. Are you still there? We hear your children in the background.
yes, I'm here.
All right.
Yeah, I'm walking.
Okay, so let's jump over to our next question. Mr. Taylor, after the Racial Integrity Act of 1924 was overturned by the Supreme Court in 1967, and I believe it was Loving versus Virginia, if I'm not mistaken, miscegenation was allowed in the United States. What are your views on miscegenation, and how big of an issue is race mixing to the future generations of white people to you? I know you're a guy who really focuses on freedom of association, associate with whom you wish. But how big of a problem is miscegenation and race mixing in the future for the white people and the white race as a whole? And what are your views on miscegenation?
There's a lot to be said on that subject. You're certainly right. I believe in freedom of association, and I think that if that small number of people who wish to marry and have children with people of a different race are bound and determined to do so, that is their choice. I think it is a bad choice for a whole host of reasons, but particularly for whites, because, as I'm sure you're well aware, we are a very small percentage of the population of the earth. We are not reproducing ourselves, and so every time white people have children with people who are not white, that's an opportunity that whites had to at least attempt to reproduce themselves, and that is an opportunity that was lost. Aside strictly from the question of numbers, and the question of numbers is an important one, because our race, if it keeps up in this manner of failing to reproduce itself, will eventually simply disappear. I think that would be a terrible, terrible tragedy. And I think most whites in their bones feel that that would be a terrible tragedy, even if they're not willing to speak out on the subject or take any measures to prevent our race from disappearing. Entirely aside from that, even in our own lifetimes, if you have a child with someone who is not of your race, for the most part, your child, say you have a child with a black person, that person is going to, your child is going to identify primarily as black. That has been the historical experience in the United States. That means that your child is going to identify with black behavior, black culture, black music, rap music, for example, all of which most whites tend to find unattractive. I think it would be, for most whites, a terrible shame to have children who moved into that kind of way of life rather than maintaining a Western European kind of texture of life. There's another aspect of this that is very little known, but that is that interracial couples, the rate of spousal homicide is 7 to 8 times higher than couples that marry within their race. In other words, simply the fact of marrying outside your race raises your chances of being murdered by your spouse by 7 or 8 times.
Is that so?
When it comes to black, yes. When it comes to black-white marriages, there's some very surprising figures. A white man who marries a black woman is about 20 times more likely to be murdered by his wife than a white man who marries a white woman. Now, the chances of being murdered by your spouse, no matter what the spouse's race, are pretty low. But I think that's still a significant differential. And likewise, if a white woman marries a black man, she's about 12 times more likely to be murdered by her black spouse than she would be by a white spouse. So, in terms of the actual survival of the people who are miscegenating, there's an initial hurdle right there. In addition to all of this, there are a number of studies that definitely indicate that people are generally better off from a mental stability point of view if they have a firm racial identity. And it's not just black-white mixes, but even Asian and black mixes, white and Hispanic mixes. Studies have shown that people who are of mixed heritage of that kind are more likely to have trouble in school, more likely to get in trouble with the law, take drugs, get pregnant, etc. It is important psychologically to have a firm racial identity. And many people think that the myth of the tragic mulatto, as they call it, this idea that a mulatto who was neither black nor white was not accepted by society, they think that's all been taken care of by modern views on race. Psychological studies show that that's not the case, that people who are neither one nor the other simply have a harder time coming to terms with who they are and being accepted in society. So there are many reasons why it is better for people to prefer to marry and have children within their own race. But again, as you have pointed out, I believe in freedom of association, and if people wish to turn their backs on their race, that is their doing. One more aspect of this, and I write about this in my book, and that is that people instinctively expect their children to look like themselves, to be like themselves. And I quote one rather heartbreaking account of a British woman who had had children with a British man. And then she remarried, and she married a man from India. And it had not occurred to her that her children with her new husband were not going to look like her. You'd think that would be an obvious thing, but it just hadn't struck her in the visceral way that it actually did when she had children with her new husband. And fucking surprise, not necessarily regret, because she claimed that she loved her new husband, but somehow the fact of having children that did not look like her was a terrible jolt, even though she had consciously married a man of a different race. So I think all of these things contribute to the fact that despite the promotion of interracial marriage that we find in society today, it doesn't happen nearly as often as one would expect, given the kind of celebration of mixing that our culture officially promotes.
That is very true. Through different means of media, including television and music, as you outlined, rap music. You're listening to The White Voice here on SaveWhitePeople.com, Brother Joe, Reverend Scott, joined by Jared Taylor of American Renaissance, amren.com. We're talking about a whole host of topics here on this Thursday evening. Mr. Taylor, you outline all these lovely facts, and all the, not lovely to us, of course, but lovely to us in a respect that it really proves our point from the white nationalist point of view. But at the same time, they're horrible facts that, of course, we wish didn't exist. Like you said, the rate of homicide amongst miscegenous relationships and cohabitation and things of that nature. Why is it that things like this, statistics and all these things, are not out in the forefront in media? And number two, why is it that you think white people are ashamed to be white? And more, I guess, in urban areas, maybe even in some suburban areas, it seems like they really struggle with their own racial identity. It's almost popular to be a non-white. Why do you think that is?
Well, to return to this question of why these unpleasant statistics do not get much attention, it's because they so directly fly in the face of the myth that Americans are all taught to believe, namely that race is an utterly insignificant matter, and that it is not a valid criterion for any kind of decision-making. Of course, once you start looking into any kind of statistical differences between the races, you'll find that race is, of course, a very significant phenomenon, not just in terms of homicide rates, but in terms of achievement rates, in terms of average IQ. In all of these respects, in the kinds of civilizations that people of different races build, it's clear that race is an extremely significant phenomenon. But because the myth today is that race doesn't matter, and with enough effort and goodwill, we can build a society in which race simply does not matter, any fact that suggests otherwise is one that you can be sure will not get any kind of sustained public attention, maybe no public attention at all.
That's very unfortunate for white people going forward, because I think, you know, I don't know if we told you already, but we are creators. We follow the creativity religion, and we find that the task most important at hand is to straighten out the thinking of the white man, because without white people realizing the statistics and all these unfortunate trends that exist, there is no way that we will go forward in building a whiter and brighter world, unfortunately. And just to expand and add my own twist on your point of view about race and different, how it's not just skin deep, I said that as well. I've had conversations with many pro-white people who seem to believe that race is not even all but 10% skin color. And it's more about the way you act, your culture, and basically, the way you act is what is going to turn people off from you. But we'll move on to the next subject here. We're going to talk about racial...
If I may, just quickly, I did want to ask Mr. Taylor a question. We were while we were on the subject of miscegenation. I was curious. We as creators, Joe mentioned that, Brother Joe. We as creators, we believe in a geographic segregation of the races. Do you believe that that is necessary to for white people to survive into the next century? A geographic separation of ourselves and non-whites.
I think unquestionably, for whites to continue to exist as a distinct people and a distinct culture, they must have territories in which they are a self-conscious majority. I'm not sure that it's absolutely necessary to have enclaves that are 100% white, but if whites are to continue, they must have some place that they can call their own and where they will be the majority and are expected to be the majority, and everyone is conscious of this necessity for the foreseeable future. Otherwise, we will simply be pushed aside by people who have sharper elbows than we do and who have no bones about pushing their group interests ahead at our expense. This was something that whites took for granted for hundreds of years, really. And until 1965, we had an immigration policy that was designed to keep the country majority white. That, of course, was overturned during what's called the Civil Rights era. I think that that was a terrible mistake. The United States had every right to maintain the kind of population that it had at that time. And the notion that somehow it did not have that right is a poisonous one. Now, the purpose of American Renaissance, the magazine that I've been editing for more than 20 years now, as well as the purpose of the book that I have just written, White Identity, it is to rekindle in whites some sense of their legitimate interests as a racial group. With every other race pushing its interests utterly unabashedly, and interests that conflict with ours, unless whites are able to regenerate some sense of white identity or white consciousness, they will, as I've just said now, they will simply be pushed aside. And I think that is a terrible, terrible self-inflicted catastrophe that we owe to our ancestors and to our descendants every effort to try to avoid.
Of course. And, you know, the sad thing about that is, as he said, and Mr. Jared Taylor said, who we're talking to from American Renaissance, amren.com here on The White Voice, a lot of other races, if not all of them, have a land that they can call exclusively their own. All the Oriental, Asian, you know, the Chinese have China, Japan is for the Japanese, and the Koreas, and so forth, and some Middle Eastern nations, and large parts of Africa are inhibited by blacks. So white people, as Mr. Taylor said, really should be allowed to have a land of their own. Now let's move on to this next subject. Mr. Taylor, Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio is one of the most vocal people in this country against illegal immigration and border control. He is the sheriff of Maricopa County in Arizona. His county's biggest focus is racial profiling. Do you feel that racial profiling is an effective crime control strategy, and is it only because the word race is within that phrase racial profiling that it gets such a bad negative rap?
Most people in their daily lives profile all the time. And when it comes to crime, for example, almost all people know and recognize and will publicly concede that men are far more dangerous than women. Likewise, most people will recognize, and they're perfectly happy to concede, that young men are more dangerous than old men. Now, from a statistical point of view, the crime rates that distinguish blacks from Asians, for example, are just as great as the distinctions between men and women, for example. So that on an average per capita basis, blacks are as much more dangerous than Asians as men are more dangerous than women. And it is perfectly normal, healthy, and sane to take this into consideration as we make our way through life. And the police, of course, are always doing profiling. They profile on the basis of appearance. They make judgments on the basis of behavior, whether or not someone reacts in a furtive manner to the approach of the police. And any policeman who's been on the street any length of time knows that blacks commit more crimes than whites. Now, the idea of using this information for crime prevention or for suspect arrest purposes is a perfectly logical one. But, I mean, it's something that can't be misused either. And obviously, if you conclude, okay, blacks are 12 times more likely than whites to commit muggings, that you then conclude, okay, I will never search for a white mugger. Now, that would be a stupid misuse of the idea of racial profiling. But to ignore these differences, to pretend that they don't matter, that's self-imposed blindness. And we find exactly the same kind of self-imposed blindness in the absolute refusal of the Transportation Safety Authority, for example, to consider the fact that young Middle Eastern men are far more likely to be potential hazards on board an airplane than anybody else. I mean, if they did some sensible racial profiling not just of race, but of religion, of appearance, of all of these things, they would not have to put absolutely everyone through this crazy search process. Likewise, any time there are population differences, it makes sense to take those differences into consideration in how you proceed if you have to make selections. And so I think that given that our society is perfectly prepared to do sex profiling and age profiling when it comes to crime, and even when it comes to serial killers, psychologists are prepared to say, this is likely to be a white guy committing this crime. In certain circumstances, racial profiling is permitted if the targets are whites. But because of the utter hysteria that has seized our country on the subject of race, as soon as race or ethnicity becomes an obvious criterion for making distinctions between different groups, then we impose this deliberate blindness on ourselves and say, no, that's out of bounds, it must not be done. It's really a form of insanity.
It indeed is. Mr. Taylor, and actually before we ask you the next question, Mr. Taylor said he's willing to answer some audience questions, proposing they're short because we only have them for a short amount of time here tonight. You can call in 718-395-9760. In a few minutes, just let me finish up the bulk of the interview here. All right, Mr. Taylor, you are widely regarded as an American white nationalist. I'm not sure if you identify yourself as that, but that is certainly how you are identified within media and within pro-white circles. You are very different from most white nationalists and pro-white persons in the respect that you do not focus on the Jewish problem. Now, without trying to question your integrity as a white man or a pro-white person, why is it that you do not focus on the Jews who have historically been parasites upon many different nations and continents on which they've put themselves in? They also control mass media and are responsible for pulling the strings behind many different forms of government, National Reserve, and certainly the way politicians get elected with lobbying and funding. So why is it that you are, I understand you focus within the United States, but why is it that you do not confront the Jewish problem, or Jewish question as it's commonly called?
Well, first of all, I don't describe myself as a white nationalist. The reason I don't do that is there's in effect no really useful term to describe people who have healthy views about race in the United States. Was Abraham Lincoln a white nationalist? Was Thomas Jefferson a white nationalist? The term just doesn't make any sense in that context. But my views about race, namely that race is a substantial aspect of group and individual identity, those views, I think, are essentially identical to those that Lincoln, Jefferson, Woodrow Wilson, practically any white person held up until about the 1960s, certainly in the 1950s. So the notion of white nationalism, I'm not quite sure what it means. My views on race are ones that have no name because they were simply taken for granted by everyone up until just a few decades ago. So I'm not quite sure that there is a good term for people who have sensible views about race. When people use a term like white nationalism, it sounds like Basque nationalists, or it sounds like the nationalists in Turkey who want a homeland for the Kurds. There's kind of a bomb-throwing sort of aroma to it. That's one reason why I would reject that term. But anyway, as far as the Jewish question is concerned, I think that whites have to take responsibility for what they do themselves. I think that it's not useful to blame our failings on the machinations of others. People who are constantly talking about and complaining about Jewish influence remind me of blacks who think that everything that's ever gone wrong for blacks in the past or ever will go wrong for blacks in the future is because of white racism. I think that blacks have to be responsible for their own successes and own failures, and I think that the whites have to as well. At the same time, I think that although many Jews are on the wrong side of questions of nationality and questions of race, I think some Jews are on the right side, and I think that it would be wrong simply to exclude them from the efforts of any kind of racial sanity in this country simply because they're Jews.
Yeah, but at the same time, Mr. Taylor, you have to, I mean, you know, you're very good at doing research, obviously, just by the content of this interview. You don't have to look very far to realize that a lot of the big corporate media outlets, NBC, Fox, CBS, 90% of these outlets are controlled by Jews who, how often would you see something black against white being proposed as a hate crime in the media, but as soon as a white person does something against a black person, it's this big national story. I mean, it's the way the media pushes things, and because they are 90% controlled by people within the Jewish either race or religion, there's the Zionist feeling behind it. And how about the Israeli interest that this government has? A politician in this country cannot get elected if he is not pro-Israel. And it is not until Barack Obama recently came out and said that Israel should retract its borders to, I believe, 1967 or 66, that a politician has really come out, a prominent politician, that is, has come out and spoke out against either Judaism, Jewish, or Israel. I mean, there are a lot of pulling of the strings behind the scenes, and I understand you don't want to go ahead and say, you know, you want to point the finger, you want to move forward, but I think once we overcome the Jewish influence, a lot of white people will have their minds straightened out, because just as we were speaking about not even 10 minutes ago, we said how these facts are not presented in the media. Through the pro-white circles...
I think that it would be a mistake to say that the media in the United States are controlled 90% by Jews. The implication there, of course, is that there is a Jewish interest that's constantly being expressed by 90% of the media. I think these days, if you were to poll Episcopalians, for example, on questions that have to do with race and nationality, you wouldn't find much difference in their views on these things from those of Jews. And again, I think the essential question is, What is it that white people must do? I think that if white people had a sensible view of their own history and their own future, it wouldn't make any difference what a small minority, whether Jewish or Episcopalian or anyone else, was doing. I think that if you had the kind of message that has been broadcast in the United States in terms of anti-racism, of anti-nationalism, in any other group, say you tried that on the Japanese, or you tried that on the Nigerians, they would just laugh at you. I think white people are particularly susceptible to appeals to a kind of altruism. I think that our very virtues are easily turned against us. But I think that it is to our own selves that we have to look for solutions rather than blame them on the machinations of others.
Okay, Reverend Scott, do you have anything else to add on that topic before we move on to the next thing?
Well, I did want to agree on a couple of points. One, I don't call myself a white nationalist either. I hate the term. I don't describe myself as one. I know a lot of other creators do. But and also... I do agree with you to a certain extent about Jewish influence and that Judaism Jews have exploited certain weaknesses that are in our people. Our race has certain weaknesses. You spoke about altruism. We've also got a love for the underdog. Now, they've exploited those weaknesses in us, in our genetic makeup, but they haven't created a weakness that wasn't already there. We have to figure out what's wrong with our people that make us that way, that make us so prone to racial suicide.
Okay, very good.
Now, I do disagree with you.
Go ahead, Scott.
I'm sorry. I do disagree. Well, go ahead, Ms. Taylor.
Well, I think that something that tends to happen to people who have the interests of whites at heart, they start fixating on the activities of Jews in a way that I think they begin to miss the point almost, that it seems that trying to counter Jews or trying to thwart their interests becomes more important than advancing our interests. I think at the same time, some people become so obsessed with Jews that they refuse to see anything good that any Jewish group or any Jewish individual is doing for our race. That, too, is a mistake. At this point, we need allies of all kinds, and I think to the extent that we can find allies among Jews or any other group, it's very foolish to try to fend them off simply because of what their religion or what their ethnic background may be.
Okay. Let's move on. You can also start calling in, guys. We only have a question or two left for Mr. Taylor here. 718-395-9760. You're listening to The White Voice here on SaveWhitePeople.com. Mr. Taylor, shortly, before we get on to the next question, so we don't take up too much of your time, what are your opinions on pro-white movements? Not necessarily just the Ku Klux Klan, but those pro-white movements, whether they employ a positive or negative image, what is your opinion on pro-white movements, and is there any critiquing that you would wish to offer them so we can all unite and go forward in this struggle?
You would have to talk about particular movements, I suppose. I think that the essential thing that unites any kind of pro-white group or person is that they want their race and culture to survive and advance. And I think it is the points on which we agree that we should really, those are the ones that we should emphasize. I certainly can't claim to be a raging success in raising the consciousness of whites as a group. Other people will have other approaches, and perhaps they'll be more successful. It's a very difficult job at this point, and although I don't quote Mao Zedong very often, I think in this respect, let 100 flowers bloom. There may be many different approaches to waking whites up, and people are welcome to choose whatever approach they find effective.
Yeah, straighten out the thinking of the white man is most important, of course. Of course, guys, I know several of you in the chat room wish to call in. We're not going to hold on to Mr. Taylor too long, so if you do wish to call in...
I do have to get off the phone pretty soon.
Very well, so let's go forward. Mr. Taylor, what solution do you propose to secure a whiter and brighter world in a land exclusively for whites?
Well, the main thing that we have to do is wake up more white people. That's clearly the key. If everyone in America, or even if just 20% of the people in America thought as I do, we'd be living in a different country. It's just that too many people don't see the world the way a sensible white person should see the world. So we're in as much an educational stage as we are a political stage. Politics is very difficult when your numbers are as small as ours, but the two can go together. I think that more whites, pro-whites, should run for office. You can start small. You can run for school board or city council. You can run for anything at all, and you'd get a tremendous amount of attention if you have a sensible pro-white message. I'm disappointed that this hasn't happened more often. I think that there's really a craving out there for for attractive candidates who would represent a sensible pro-white position. And at the same time, education has to be an ongoing process.
Very true. 816, I believe this is Steve. Please make it quick as we're trying to get Mr. Taylor off the phone here. Go ahead.
First of all, I want to thank Jared Taylor. I appreciate you coming on, and it was very much an honor to listen to you speak today. So now what I would like to do is talk just a little bit more. I have a question. It's kind of generic. Do you believe that white people have natural enemies? And then you can go ahead and respond to that however you'd like. What is your thought on that?
I suppose any group that is competing for resources in a world of limited resources has natural enemies to that extent. I think, but they are natural enemies on the extent that we permit them to be. If whites have lost the kind of group identification that is necessary for them to say, yes, this is our territory, this is our culture, this is our country, and sorry, you have to stay where you are. To the extent that they've lost that, then they have created very dangerous natural enemies, because other people are not going to be inhibited by the fact that we are the majority or that we have built a society. They will come in. We would have no natural enemies, or something, certainly no dangerous enemies, if we had a healthy view of ourselves as a people and a healthy view of what was required to preserve our people and our civilization. So, yes, all groups have natural competitors, but I don't think that they would be enemies of a serious kind, except to the extent that we permit them to be.
Okay, Mr. Taylor, how, and this is a text, and this will be the last question we ask you here on the program tonight, how can we successfully change the negative direction of our race and nation through a destroyed and corrupt political system?
Well, I have not given up completely on the political system. I think that if we give up completely on it, then we have lost any chance of trying to really have any of the levers of change that are a legitimate part of most any society. If you give up on politics completely, what opportunity do you have to change the way a society works? I think that, as I said before, that politics is something that is still a possibility. I think that certainly at small levels, at local levels, there is a lot of ground that could be usefully plowed. And I think it's just a matter of candidates coming forward. If you look at the comments sections of many mainstream newspapers on the Internet, you'll find that many of the commenters clearly have a racial consciousness. It's just they don't have anyone to vote for. They don't have anyone to follow as a leader. I think that if that constituency out there is waiting to be cultivated in many different places, and it's a matter of step forward in cultivating it.
Okay.
Anyway, it's been a pleasure to be on, but I do have to get off. I was only expecting to be on about a half an hour, and it's gone 45 minutes now.
That's too long.
And I do have some things I need to tend to.
Very too. White identity, racial consciousness in the 21st century. Check out Jared Taylor's new book. Mr. Taylor, real quick, have you ever read Nature's Eternal Religion or The White Man's Bible?
No, I have not. I've not heard of that book.
Well, we'll certainly forward you a copy in the future. Thank you for coming on, Mr. Taylor. Sorry we ran a little bit late, but thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
That's Jared Taylor, American Renaissance.